Welcome everyone to Action Perspective Podcast, where we talk to others about how they use psychological flexibility to address human suffering. Today, we're talking to Dr. Eli Quinn, a clinical psychologist out of Toronto, Canada, who will share his experience using an integrative approach, using process-based therapy, such as compassion-focused therapy combined with acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT, to treat complex trauma in children and adolescents. Please help me welcome Dr. Eli Quinn. How are you doing?
I'm good. Yeah, thanks for asking.
Yeah.
How's everything in the States with all the political turmoil? Wow. It must be especially
stressful. It's disheartening.
Yeah.
And it's you know, we're living in history. I mean, this is really an educational moment for kids right now. I mean, I have 14-year-old, soon to be 15. I have an 11-year-old, and we've never experienced anything like this before. How do you explain that to these kids?
Yeah.
Along with COVID, along with everything else going on. And then they go back to school and they're expected to, have a relevant education.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't really talk about this. They don't talk about any relevant issues like this. And I think this is a missed opportunity in education.
For sure. And I think it is hard on kids too. A lot of youngsters get so preoccupied with all the drama that's going on in the world. And then
they're
asked to just kind of like compartmentalize that and focus on school without any acknowledgement of what's going on. It's almost like a toxic positivity kind of situation.
Yeah. I know, isn't it? This is my second podcast, so I thank you for being here.
Yeah, congratulations. It's a pretty cool initiative that you're trying out.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, thank you. You're in Toronto, right? Mm-hmm. Out of Toronto, Canada. And so you've been a clinical psychologist and have been using compassion-focused therapy with kids, teens, and caregivers for the past 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
You started by doing CFT, compassion-focused therapy, with teens in a secure detention facility with great effect. And you've also used CFT with teens who have neurodevelopmental disorders, such as learning disabilities, ADHD, high-functioning ASD, which is autism spectrum disorder, and you're in private practice. You're currently completing a postdoctoral fellowship, and you're doing a pilot evaluation of CFT for teens and their caregivers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll ask you more about that. You have a rough draft of a manual that you're using and anticipate that you'll be running the first set of participants this month.
Mm-hmm.
Have you already started?
We haven't. There's just been like a series of problems with ethics and stuff like that.
Yeah, but that's kind of to be expected?
It is, especially we're doing it through a community-based participatory research framework. So we're with actual clinics in the community.
So
there's just lots of different stakeholders who need different kinds of approvals and paperworks and stuff like that. So
yeah,
I'm bad at that stuff. So I make mistakes on it like every step of the way.
Yeah. And you also are co-chair of the Ontario chapter of ACBS, which is the Association for Contextual Behavioral Science,
mm-hmm.
and on the board of Applying ACT for Addictions, the special interest group under the Contextual Behavioral Science. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome. And so I asked you here to talk a little bit more about compassion-focused therapy, especially in working with children and adolescents. I think that's really relevant today. I know this much about it, okay? This is a little bit of background on why I first stumbled upon it. So I have in applied behavior analysis, never had learned this in graduate school. I had stumbled upon this after I had learned acceptance and commitment therapy, and then under contextual behavioral science, so I was learning that, and stumbled upon the Facebook page of compassion-focused therapy. And I was thinking to myself, my eyes rolled, and oh my God, here's another model. It's like, how many models are there out there? And isn't this redundant? Do we really need this? Is this another ACT model? Is this someone who's stroking their ego? Or is this something very different and needed? And how does this integrate with ACT, or does this compete with ACT? And I want to let you explain more of that. So that's a little bit of background. And then I ran into this guy, Dr. Dennis Tersch, and you know Dr. Tersch as well. Fabulous guy. And I had run into him on Twitter, and just what he would say, and I saw some of his videos, just really attracted me to learn more.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a bit about who you are and like where you're from, if you can give a little context on that, and how you got involved in this.
Yeah, sure. I think the way I got involved is kind of similar to you. I started by training in ACT and doing some ACT work, and then came across CFT and kind of globbed onto that as an additional model. But a bit about me personally. So like you said, I'm in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, which is one of the largest urban centers in Canada. It's a little bit unique in that there's a lot more kind of organized or semi-organized crime in Toronto, especially amongst like racialized youth. Whereas just for context for the juvenile justice stuff, whereas other contexts in Canada, juvenile justice kind of has a different flavor to it. So it's a bit unique. And the center where I started doing CFT and really finding my footing in it is actually the largest secure detention facility for youth in Canada. So some program and decision makers decided it'd be a good idea to make like a super detention facility. So you could get all the resources, tons of psychologists, tons of social workers, like all the stuff all in one place. But there's pros and cons to that model. But so that's one lens of the context. I guess the other context is that in my private practice, by virtue of it being private practice, tends to be higher income families. Insurance in Canada for mental health care is getting better, but most healthcare in Canada is covered through federal insurance programs that just come out of your regular taxes. But there's not a lot of flexibility on how you can get your mental health care needs through that. There's hospital-based programs, there's community mental health centers. But if you are falling between the cracks or the wait lists are too long and you want to go private, then it's kind of out of pocket.
Is that expensive? Like super expensive?
It is expensive, yeah. Because I think research shows that on average, a course of therapy for like an adolescent is going to range from 12 to 20 sessions. Yeah. It's like kind of the lower end of duration when there's not a lot of complexity. The costs get up there. And then if you want to do parent training at the same time, which I think is a big part of child and adolescent work, then the costs converge in quite quickly. And what else would help to give you context? I'm doing my postdoc with a lovely research group called the Center for School Mental Health from a university in London, Ontario, which is called the University of Western Ontario. And I've been so lucky to work with my supervisor, Claire Crooks. She's just a great intervention researcher. She doesn't know much about CFT per se, but she has like innumerable publications on intervention research and how to adapt programs for different settings and stuff like that. So I'm learning a lot there, and she's done a lot to help support me.
Good. Good.
Yeah.
And your focus has generally been adolescents, teens, correct?
Yeah, I trained as a child and adolescent psychologist, but in Canada, we have like in clinical psych, we have a residency year, and then there's another year of supervised practice, which I think in America, you guys call a postdoc. Yeah. In my postdoc year, I retrained to work with adults, and I've been doing a lot of adult work since then. But in my training, I also saw a lot of adult clients, especially like university aged clients, emerging adults who are transitioning from being really embedded within their family context to being really individuated.
Yeah.
And we have a little bit of wiggle room in Ontario about whether or not you can treat them as an adolescent psychologist or if you need to be a fully registered adult psychologist. So I saw a lot of those folks. But yeah. I think there's a big gap in the literature and direction on how to use CFT and ACT, well, mainly CFT with kids and teens.
Yeah.
And because that's where I'd done most of my training in that age group, in that context, I thought maybe I can lend my voice to that choir, and maybe it's totally wrong and other people say, no, it's actually more like this, and that'll propel the field in a great direction. Or maybe people say, oh yeah, maybe there's something to that. So I'm just giving it a shot, and hopefully it's helpful to somebody.
Good. And I suspect a lot of our listeners don't have any idea what CFT is, and we'll get on that. But I really do want to set the stage of you are, Toronto is now southern, pretty close to New York, correct?
Yeah.
So just inside Canada, is there a difference? Now, do you know the American model pretty well, or the U.S. model pretty well,
in terms of
all the challenges that we have in terms of insurance and things like that? Does that relate pretty well to what you're going through in Canada?
Yeah, I have a rough idea of what's happening in America, but I'm sure there's tons of nuance that's really important that I'm missing.
Yeah.
I think it's in Canada, each province is in charge of their own healthcare. So it's kind of like if each state was in charge of their own healthcare. So it changed, like the availability of mental health services is really going to change from province to province, and also from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So if you're in a more rural and remote area, there are notorious challenges getting adequate mental health care. But I think that's been changing recently, which is really good. The government of Ontario recently launched an ICBT, clinician-assisted internet-based CBT program. So ICBT, where it's kind of self-directed work, but you can check in with a clinician as often as you want. So you could get free weekly sessions, but really the model is you do the CBT stuff and you talk to the clinician on how to apply it to your life. So I'm really hopeful that things will change. And I think there's an increased recognition. Notably, the Prime Minister of Canada right now, Justin Trudeau, his family has had a lot of mental health challenges, and they've been really open about that. So he's a big champion of the provision of mental health care, and he's really, in lots of his talks to the nation, will take a moment to describe kind of how things are impacting him emotionally or personally or their family systems. And I think that's the step in the right direction. So,
I think that's a very healthy, I didn't know that he had that background, his family had that background, he was so open about it. Our president is also very open about his mental health issues, although not in the same way.
Right. But I just want to, sorry to interrupt, I don't want that kind of like optimistic trend to overshadow the tons of people who really need help and can't get it.
Yeah.
Like that's also a problem, and it does happen. So those are kind of two sides that are occurring simultaneously, but.
Yeah. Could you get into explain what compassion focused therapy is? But when you're doing that, if you could explain that in the proper context of contextual behavior science, acceptance and commitment therapy or training, and all the other models of flexibility that you've been trained in or that you know of, so kind of people have a proper understanding of it.
Sure. Before I jump into that, I should just provide a disclaimer that I'm not like a CFT trainer. I'm not accredited or anything. So I'm happy to share my perspectives and my experience of what's worked and what hasn't. Just throwing that out there. So the thing about CFT, is funny because Paul Gilbert and his research group, the folks who developed it, aren't really situated within the ACBS context. They're just doing their own thing over in the UK.
Okay.
But the nature of the therapy is a contextually based intervention. And then Dennis Turch and Laura Silverstein kind of learned about this and wrote their book, The Compassionate, or The ACT Practitioner's Guide to Compassion, or something like that. And they did a really good job of articulating how CFT can be situated within an ACBS framework, and then I think like Dennis was the president of the ACBS recently, and so it just kind of got a lot of momentum within the ACBS community.
Yeah, yeah.
In my opinion, what makes something ACT, like ACT consistent or contextually behavior science consistent? To me, it really comes down to RFT and whether or not your intervention is all about trying to transform the stimulus function. Whether you're looking at how did these behavioral repertoires emerge within a person's lived context, and CFT or lived history, and CFT expands that to also their evolutionary context, their evolutionary history. So how did it emerge, and how can you transform those stimulus functions? So the classic example that I like to talk about is if you've ever seen a really young kid, like 2 or 3, and in a car and a police flashes their lights behind you, and the kid notices, they get really excited. They think something awesome is happening. Meanwhile, the driver's like, fuck. really stressing out about it. And it's the same stimulus, but because of their lived history, the function of that stimulus of the lights and the sirens has a new meaning for an adult, because it means they're getting all kinds of other problems. And that's a pretty simple example, but it can become really complex and difficult to think about when it comes to human language and also the ways that we relate to ourselves. So that when you think about myself, say coming on a podcast, what is the function of that thought going to have? What are those lights going to do to me? Going to put me into a threat-based mentality? I'm going to look like an idiot and everyone's going to see me screw up, Or is it going to be more a drive mentality? Or, you know, what's it going to be all about?
Yeah.
I'll jump into that a bit more afterwards. But to me, that's what contextual behavior science is all about. It's all about, are you intentionally trying to find those stimuli that elicit the problematic behavioral repertoire? Mm-hmm. And then you're trying to do something to transform the function of that stimulus. And I think CFT does try to do that.
Yeah.
Intentionality. And so in that way, I think that's really where the overlap happens. And I would argue actually that all process experiential therapies do that. So therapies where the goal is to be in the moment with the client, and you're kind of on the leading edge of the unfolding of their consciousness as they're going through the function, and you're trying to deepen, kind of like evoke the specific repertoires or stimuli that are problematic for the person, and then you shape a new way of them relating to it, and then you reinforce that new way of being. I think that like evoke, shape, reinforce is how process experiential therapies lead to change. So just to make it a bit more concrete, if you had somebody who's struggling with self-criticism and they start telling you a story about some TV show, and then like, oh, sorry, like here I am blathering away again. And then you kind of slow it down and say, whoa, what just happened there? You showed a big part of yourself to me, something you really loved. And then immediately your mind went to this kind of slapping you down, criticizing you. Can we just, and then you evoke what that self-critical process is, and you shape a new way of relating to being disclosing interpersonally, and then reinforce that through just regular relational processes. I think that's what ACT does. I think that's what all process experiential therapies do, and CFT does that too. And that's why I think that's really where it overlaps with ACT. Mm-hmm. And then there's also been some research out there as we get to like what CFT looks like. There's some people out there who have written how the different CFT like skills that you train and attributes that you try to foster overlap with the attributes of psychological flexibility. So that's another way in which it is the same, is kind of like more topographic. But then just one more thought on how they're the same is that when you're doing ACT, you are always kind of wondering, is the problematic behavioral repertoire, is that stimulus under aversive antecedent control, or is it under consequential control? Uh-huh. So if it's under consequential control, that's when you can start doing a lot of values work and committed action stuff. And
good point,
and start getting people to practice new ways of being. But if it's under aversive antecedent control, that repertoire is really rigid and inflexible and narrow. If you've learned to be really shame-based and self-attacking whenever people kind of see part of you, If I'm like, I'll give you $1 million to not hate yourself anymore, it's not going to help you.
Yeah, you know? Right. Yeah, it's not that easy.
Yeah. And so the thing is, when you're in a caregiving mentality and you've activated those compassionate affective states, just naturally that behavioral repertoire becomes wider. Mm-hmm. And so in as much as ACT does all these really cool things to elicit and evoke and then shape new ways of being to get more of that widening and flexibility, I think mm-hmm. CFT does that also, because all the compassion-based interventions naturally widen the repertoire, which allow for new shaping and reinforcing of a new way of being.
Yeah.
And I also think when you're doing compassion-focused work, most of it is a self-as-context intervention. Like, you have to be kind of diffused and you're switching from these different motives and part selves to help yourself out. So,
yeah. I heard a lot of similarities between ACT and CFT. How are they different?
I think there's actually a whole book that I haven't read out there, like comparing and contrasting CFT to ACT. So those guys probably know the answer a lot better than me. My hunch or my clinical experience, I think the difference is that CFT places more of an emphasis on the emotional components, whereas ACT places more of an emphasis on your relationship to your thoughts. I also think in ACT, there's a lot of really wonderful technologies to help with values clarification and how to start pursuing those things. And in CFT, that stuff happens, but it happens from a care of well-being perspective. Mm-hmm. But the technologies aren't as well articulated. And then I also think that CFT does a lot to train and shape a caregiving and care receiving behavioral repertoire. Yeah. And ACT doesn't have that as a thing per se. But if you go to ACT trainings, you listen to ACT practitioners or listen to podcasts, people often say that compassion, self-compassion is like the secret seventh process in the Hexaplex. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in the black and white on the pages, they're in ACT, you're not doing that as much. But in actual practice, I think ACT practitioners are attending to those compassionate processes. And
yeah,
actually, like Steve Hayes says all the time, that this is just his first guess of what components lead to psychological flexibility, and some of them might be taken out and some new ones might be added. And the beautiful thing about ACT is that it's empirically driven. And so just like all science, like if it works, it's gonna continue to propagate, and if it doesn't work, then it's gonna evolve to something new. So who knows, maybe at some point compassion will become part of the Hex. And that'll be like what a Septiflex or something.
Yeah, we were just having and Steve Hayes was part of a recent discussion on a SIG group about a philosophy SIG group, right? About the difference between mechanistic model and the contextualistic model, and he even argued, says, you know, that I'm going to butcher this, but basically he said there's more evidence based for the mechanistic model, that most people are mechanistic and contextualistic. And that my understanding of it is that, you know, the contextual based science is so difficult to kind of maintain the proper outcomes. A very different side with a contextualistic model that doesn't translate as easy as a mechanistic model. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think that makes so much, that's really true. And I think that's true, like both from an experimental design perspective. But also just from, I think what he's talking about is less about the design side and more just about how humans work. And there's like a nice anecdote that is like a case in point for that. Mm-hmm. Which is that the research group I'm working with in London, Ontario, is studying this program that teaches vulnerable youth different types of skills. So relationship skills, how to form and end relationships, drug refusal skills, mm-hmm. How to like exit human trafficking situations and avoid human trafficking situations. Yeah. And for the drug refusal, it's also harm reduction. And then the fourth component is mental health, basic tier one mental health promotion. And we're doing this in a bunch of settings. Like, some of them are children in conflict with the law. Some of them are children in the child custody setting. Some of them are Indigenous folks living in remote communities. And, you know, there's just like, some of them are LGBTQ plus youth. And so they're all going to have different needs. So it's the same intervention, but the outcomes are going to be different depending on the group. And so we're trying to register this clinical trial, and we have to say, what are the outcomes we're expecting? And it depends on their context and their lived history and which skills are they actually able to use. Yeah. I know that these vulnerable youth living in high crime neighborhoods are, and we also know Indigenous youth, there's super high chance of being victims of human trafficking.
Yeah.
But if they haven't been a victim of human trafficking in the 6 months of the trial, I mean, you're going to see no effect from that branch. But it doesn't mean that those skills aren't useful later on. And I know that's not exactly what he's talking about, but it's kind of like another, it's a nice, I think, instance to reflect how when you're trying to understand everything in context, it's such a rich
that
if you do
multi-leveled context,
you don't know where those effects are going to ripple through that phenomenological network.
Right. Yeah. And do you have, what specific problems do you see then in Toronto that you're dealing with? I mean, is just a wide range of human trafficking and suicidal ideation and depression? Like, is there anything that's very specific to your area, or are you just runs the whole gamut?
Yeah, I think it's like any large city, it runs the whole gamut. Like, Toronto's a little bit unique compared to a lot of like different geographic areas in Canada, where are some of the ways in which our like conflict with the law type issues get expressed is more similar to an American model. And most of Canada's not like that. So that's why Toronto is a bit unique from a Canadian context, but in terms of the big picture of things, it's like any big city, you're gonna have the same kinds of difficulties you see in any urban.
Yeah, and also, is it also racially and ethnically diverse as well?
It is. Actually, I think, I don't know if it's still true, but for quite a while, Toronto had the record for the most ethnically diverse city in the world in terms of the different nationalities represented. But I think like a lot of other areas or jurisdictions in Canada, a lot of the race-based violence is really targeted towards Indigenous and First Nations folks, like the FNMI community. And in Toronto, it's a lot more targeted towards Black and Brown youth. And it's not like black and white that there's only this kind of discrimination here and that kind there, but that's kind of like a bit of a unique divide, where most of Canada, there's a lot of systematic oppression and violence against the FNMI community. But there's just not as much FNMI representation in urban Toronto as there are in other jurisdictions in Canada.
Okay. All right. Yeah. You know, and we had mentioned before, or you had mentioned, there's a difference between the CFT model, using the CFT model with adults and children, right? Adolescents and teens. Can you explain that?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, the cool thing about CFT is that they, in a way, argue that the ways in which people respond to their emotional distress is what causes unhelpful cycles or patterns of being in the world that are like pathological in quotations. And so what you're doing in CFT is you're helping people develop and access this caregiving repertoire so that they can give themselves care, and also a care receiving repertoire, working through some of the fears and blocks and resistances to letting that soothing and caring come in. So as Brené Brown says, you have a bad day and then you go home and have a beer and a muffin and you stimulate all that pleasure stuff. And in CFT, you're trying to shape a new way of relating to that stress so that you're promoting more adaptive patterns of being in the world.
Yeah.
And in many ways, what you're doing is you're training. I don't know if you know much about attachment theory, but what you're kind of doing, you're training a secure attachment relationship mm-hmm. with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you're creating this relationship with yourself mm-hmm. where you can show up to your, it's kind of the language becomes funny, but your felt sense of self can show up to your observer self, I guess, with pain and distress. Mm-hmm. And you trust that that's going to be met with soothing and appropriate care and validation. And then there's also the other side of attachment, which is that there's trust that I can jump out into the world and make mistakes and I'll be okay generally. So there's that also relationship with yourself. And that's not an explicit goal of CFT, but in the CFT literature, they talk a lot about how the caregiving and compassion systems are an extension of the attachment system. And I think that's really true. It's just that these interpersonal repertoires, because we have language, we can internalize them and relate to ourselves in much the same way as we relate to others. And so in CFT, in lots of ways, you're training people how to have a secure attachment relationship with themselves.
Yeah.
But the nice thing with kids and teens is you have so much opportunity to actually change their attachment relationship with their caregivers. Yeah. And so I think the role of parent training and parent work when you're working with kids and teens is paramount, because you can help parents kind of act out and meet their children's emotional and behavioral needs in much the same way that you treat adults, how to meet their own emotional and behavioral needs. And so that way the child is actually having this repertoire modeled and reinforced over time. And I think there's lots of benefits to that, not only from a default pattern of self-relating and a skills mm-hmm. repertoire, but I think it also just creates richer, more connected, supportive families. And I think those benefits will kind of like spill out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And so, no, and you mentioned before how important it is to work with the whole family. I mean, mm-hmm. you're not only working with the child, but you're doing parent training as well. And that's a necessary basis for kind of successful therapy.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I think the other thing is that adults, through no fault of their own, you know, we all just find ourselves here with this way of being that we didn't exactly choose. A lot of adults struggle with accessing and expressing their primary adaptive emotions. Mm-hmm. And that's where a lot of problems and difficulties can stem from. So when you're working with adults, you often have to spend a lot of time creating a relational context where it's safe enough to actually express some of those primary vulnerable stuff. But kids and teens, in my experience, are often less guarded. And so you can get them to do that like deeper work kind of like right off the bat, which is pretty cool. But on the flip side, they mm-hmm. have way less control over their environments. You know, like
right.
They're forced to be in these school contexts and these family contexts, and they don't have nearly as much agency to drive the direction of their day-to-day life as adults have. And I think there's also lots of unique stresses that kids and youth are facing. So it's a mixed bag. So it looks a little bit different too, because you'll maybe spend less time needing to build the same like emotion fluency skills, because kids haven't forgotten that emotional way of being it, but then there's other stuff that you have to address instead.
No, it raised a good question about, in terms of the flexibility, I would suspect that kids are more flexible than adults, right? That adults tend to be more rigid, much more complex thinkers. So there's a much more complex relational network around their ideas, what a good parent or bad parent ought to be. And that's harder to crack in a way than mm-hmm. with child, because I mean, child is just kind of new to the world, has a much far less complex network, but also much more flexible in that. Is that true? Am I getting that right?
Yeah, I think like as a blanket statement, that's true. But there's like a weird thing that happens where when you have vulnerable youth who have experienced interpersonal trauma or lots of misattunement from caregivers, mm-hmm. Or lots of really scary, hard stuff, they're like really protected. The spikes are there. They can shut down in ways that you don't see happening as overtly in adults. I think in adults they do many of the same kinds of protective things, but they've been socialized through their lived history to put that in a in an interpersonal context. That's a little like there's more like hooks that you can start to get into, like more footholds with adults. But I've worked with lots of teens who come in and they'll just sit there and they won't say a word no matter what you try to do. You try to validate the silence and you do all this jazz and they'll just not say anything. But you never really see that with an adult because no adult's gonna self-select to go to intervention if they're just gonna be silent the whole time.
Right.
You know
what I mean?
But teens can be forced to show up to therapy.
Yeah, I also suspect too that the parents have there's a perceived threat. You are a perceived threat to a parent that any inkling of or suspicion of child abuse, child neglect, they could turn into a legal issue as well, an embarrassing legal issue, or at least just feel judged as parents, like, oh, I must be a bad parent because, I just didn't know how to cope with my child's emotional difficulties.
Yeah.
You know? Instead of saying, listen, I want to be very open and honest and embrace a different kind of path. What do you see in terms of, working with parents? Are they, they tend to be more open, more closed, or there's both?
Yeah, it's like the classic ACT answers, it depends. I've seen both. In my experience, I've had to call children's aid. We call it children's aid services here in Ontario. I don't even know how many times, maybe like 20 or 30 times. And I've never had a really problematic experience. In my experience, like, parents want what's best for their kids.
Yeah.
And if you show that you're going to be there with their parents and you're going to be there when you make the call so that the parents feel supported in it, and you check in with the parents afterwards, most of the time, it's okay. I have a colleague who does these assessments that CAS eventually uses to determine if the parents have enough competency to be able to have the kids return home. And I imagine he has a lot harder experiences with parents because that's kind of like at the end of the road when push comes to shove. But at first, it's more like a preliminary investigation and offering support and counseling. And one of the main things CAS will often recommend off the bat is to go to therapy and work through some of these issues. And we discovered this because they were in therapy. So when parents are collaborative and open with the CAS, it often it works okay in my experience. But like I said, my context is in the private practice setting, a lot more like less vulnerable communities. So and I've heard lots of horror stories about CAS, but I've also heard lots of pretty warm, heart-touching stories. So it's pretty diverse. But knowing a lot of CAS workers through some of my work currently, their hearts are always in the right place. In Canada, there's a really big push to always keep families together wherever possible and safe. Doesn't happen all the time, but
I worked in child protective services for a number of years, so I know that side and the difficulty of what parents face and the challenges that they face. Shifting gears here and talking about the child, you have a child coming in, they have an issue with high anxiety, maybe OCD developing, and in the context of all the challenges that are facing now with education, all the contingencies that they have to meet with COVID. I don't know how bad COVID is there, but of course, I mean, it's horrible here. I'm sure it's equally as horrible in Toronto at this time, right? Or are you seeing spikes?
Yeah, well, I think like our numbers are way lower. The percentage of our population is lower, but We're on lockdown. We've been in basically lockdown for, I don't know, it's like 60 days already.
The looming fear is there.
Being being done remotely over school now. So there's a lot of stress and turmoil.
So, you know, a child comes to see, you know, a parent and child come to see you and say, hey, listen, you know, my child is experienced high levels of stress, maybe engaging in self-harm, has a problem with social media, because I'm all that. What's one of the first things that you do? Approach that. A broad question, but
I always try to do a pretty thorough assessment, not a diagnostic assessment necessarily, but really trying to understand, you know, how did the child come to struggle in this way? And what are the different possible strengths and resiliency factors that we can leverage to try to promote change? And where are the places that are likely to be stuck and what should we do about those? And what are the places that are going to be like turbo boosts that we can really rely on up front? And then I think the relationship, at the end of the day, we have all these great technologies like ACT metaphors and CFT imagery things and CFT skills that you can train and psychoeducation, all these great social technologies. But at the end of the day, like the relationship has to be the primary mechanism of change, because that's the medium in which all those technologies are delivered and practiced and everything like that. So I think my first step is building a safe and trusting relationship with the kid and their parents. Every family is different. Some kids and teens refuse parent involvement. Some parents refuse to be involved. Some parents are like locked up in custody, or they're deceased, or there's like been a really acrimonious divorce and there's no co-parenting happening. It's like all with one parent and not the other. So there's all kinds of permutations, and you just work with what you can. But whoever is involved, I try to foster like a safe and open and trusting relationship with those people. And that's my first step, is try to figure out how did they come to struggle in these ways and what do they want out of their intervention, and creating that relationship.
And in terms of using ACT and integrating that with CFT, how do those work together? Are they separate? Are they kept separate? Or are they blended?
Yeah, I'm really not like a fundamentalist when I come to intervention. I'll just grab whatever works, and you know, in line with what ACT argues is they say they're all about technical eclecticism and theoretical consistency. And I'm a big believer in that. So I'll use technologies from wherever I find them, as long as theoretically it's consistent, so that you're trying to alter either the actual environmental context and or the person's intrapsychic context, so that when those problematic, like when the stimulus gets elicited that creates a problematic behavior repertoire, that you can transform the stimulus function of that thing. So I'll use ACT stuff, I'll use CFT stuff, I'll kind of borrow. I'll also use some CBT stuff and some emotion-focused family therapy stuff. I'm a bit of a scoundrel like that, I guess. But
do you ever use mindfully based meditations?
Is that
successful, generally successful with children?
Yeah, there's a lot of emerging research showing that you can train mindfulness in kids. I'm currently evaluating this program called Mind Up, which was kind of funded through the Goldie Hawn Foundation. And it's basically a tier 1 prevention initiative for really young kids to teach them mindfulness skills. And so we're looking at it in kids like aged 4 to 6. And I ran one set of multi-level models and things are looking good, but I need to run a few more. So this isn't like the final answer, but it seems to be the case that it increases self-regulation and decreases emotional difficulties in kids as young as 4 to 6. I think it can be learned at any age, but the way you do it is different. You do it a lot shorter. There's some research showing that adolescents dislike compassion-focused imagery work. In CFT, you do there's these different skills that you train, and through the training of those skills, you foster the attributes that go into a compassionate or caregiving kind of motive and state of mind. And one of the skills is imagery, and the imagery work in CFT is so impactful for lots of folks, and it's a big part of the intervention. And there is one paper I read where youth didn't like, they reported that they disliked the imagery and found it not to be helpful. But I've been doing imagery with teens for, my whole short, albeit short career. And it works well with most kids. And I think it's because the traditional CFT imagery scripts are quite long. Like if you go to the, Dennis Turch has this great SoundCloud account with all the CFT imagery meditations. And they're all like 20 or 30 minutes, and kids just don't have that.
Yeah.
Intentional focus. So I'll do the same things, but I'll shorten it a lot. I'll make it a lot. Same with me with mindfulness stuff. And then kind of in line with what I was saying earlier about theoretical consistency, like I'll always think about like, why would I be doing this mindfulness thing? What am I trying to help the person do? I think there's a lot of spiritual benefits to mindfulness, and I think it's like as a tier one prevention initiative, it's great to teach and foster in anybody. But if you're going to be using part, you have like such a small dose. You have like an hour a week, let's say at most, in most of the time. If you're going to be spending, you know, let's say do a 10 minute mindfulness thing, if you're going to spend 1/6 of your session doing that, I'd want to be really thoughtful about what is the outcome I'm hoping that this will achieve, if you know what I mean. So you can use that to do some skill building in terms of like diffusion and noticing your thoughts as they pass. You can use it a little bit as a focusing kind of technique from an emotion focused therapy style of focusing, like a gestalt focusing where you notice and deepen your emotional experience or sensory experience in the moment and see what meaning emerges from that. You can, there's this awesome program I was involved with for a while called Mindfulness Martial Arts. And that uses, I mean, they say CBT, but when I read the manual, it was really acty. And then I spoke to the program people and they said that when they wrote the program, they were really into ACT at the time, but the evidence base wasn't there. So they made sure it had like 1 foot firmly grounded in CBT when they wrote the manual and got their funding and everything. So, I mean, they say CBT based, but it's really ACT consistent the way that it works. And And what you do in that intervention, the first like 30 minutes is kind of like group therapy, but it's more didactic. You do a meditation, there's some psychoeducation about stuff, a little bit of discussion, and then you do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu for the rest of it. And then in the middle of the jiu-jitsu, the instructors will say things like, okay, stop and tune into your mind and notice how you're struggling against this discomfort. Are you in fight, flight, or freeze? And you use some of those mindfulness skills to come into the present moment and open your awareness and try to use a more skillful way of responding to the discomfort. And then you go back to the jiu-jitsu and then you stop. And then, so it's like really in context, and there's such nice multiple exemplar training. Opportunity in that. So so in that program we do tons of mindfulness, and then you use mindfulness intentionally kind of as the mechanism to open up and widen that behavioral repertoire so that you can practice new ways of being when you're in those threat-based mindsets. So I think mindfulness is pretty cool with young kids, but I wouldn't just do it to do it. I think I would want to be really intentional about what am I hoping to use this for later on.
Right. No, I'm reminded about the, you know, how Steve Hayes had those finger traps where it's like, you know, I had a supervisor, Joanne Steinwax, who said, she had bought a whole bunch of those finger traps to act as metaphors, and they just went to waste, you know, I mean, but so it just reminds me of what you were saying, that, you know, if you're going to use a metaphor, and training like that, make it relevant.
Yeah.
You know? And so what works for one, you know, this is what can, how where it come, you know, what works for one is not going to work for the other.
Mm-hmm.
It's very individualistic. Yeah. Yeah. And
oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, I was just kind of thinking along the lines of how great it is, right, to live in this time, at this time in our lives, where the science has actually caught up with, you know, thousands of years of Eastern thought. And, you know, we were talking about the integration of all these signs of evolutionary science, cognitive science, neuroscience, even behavioral science, and all kind of integrated into a nice kind of really nice models of now what we call psychological flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
That's beautiful, but it seems like, you know, this has been mentioned before, as the years progress, we're getting worse, right? We have more technology, but yet we have more problems. We have more human suffering. We just can't, you know, come to terms with why and how we suffer and how to cure that and how to alleviate suffering.
Mm-hmm.
What are, in your mind, are the contingencies of the push-pull? That makes sense.
It does. Well, I think there's obviously a lot that goes into that. So if you accept the assumption that there's kind of like two different processes, some that are causing deterioration that are like harmful and some that are helpful, and rather than being two ends of one continuum, they're kind of like two parallel processes. And so in terms of what's leading things to get worse, I think the way in which society has shifted over time makes it very difficult to form rich interpersonal relationships and communities. Mm-hmm. And we know that people are relational beings. We need to be connected to a rich network of folks, and more it's difficult to establish and maintain that. And I mean, there's a million and one reasons why that's the case. From the increase in natural disasters and health crises, like currently, it's just not safe or possible to meet different people unless you're doing it virtually like this, to the fact that it's easier to stay marginally connected through large geographic distances. So you pursue work far away from kind of like that original community. You know, then there's lots of technologies that make it really easy to have these less rich interactions. So I mean, there's tons of reasons from that side. I think another thing that is leading to more harm or psychological pain and suffering is that there's a lot more uncertainty in the world than there might otherwise have been, or at least you're in contact with that uncertainty a lot more than it might have been. And it's really easy to, like, as they say now, doom scroll and be connected to all these images of human suffering. And so in earlier times, maybe you would know that there was a war somewhere and you would feel some sadness, but now you can see all these horrific images and it'll play a constant loop. Even yesterday, I'm losing track of time now. When the protesters stormed the White House, I got a panicked text message from my father saying, oh, check out CNN, things are going bad, and like with so much urgency. Mm-hmm. I'm like, what are you gonna do about it, dad? CFT, they have this saying that your attention are the fingers that play the piano keys of your mind. And so I'm like, you can attend to all that pain and suffering in a much more easy and visceral and in depth kind of way. I think those are some of the reasons why things are getting worse. And then in terms of things getting better, I think that we're starting to understand and we're getting a lot better at it, but I also think there's a long way to go. Mm-hmm. We have a good evidence base showing that psychotherapy is effective, but it's only been in the last 5-10 years that we're starting to articulate how and why it's effective. And that's part of why I started getting so passionate about ACT and the contextual behavior science community in the beginning, because they were trying to articulate that. but process coding studies are pretty new, and they're few and far between in terms of like exactly what do you say when that causes change. And still, although psychotherapy is effective, I think in youth, it's really only about 50% of people who will experience significant or like complete resolution of their difficulties, which is a lot compared to physical medicine. Like, that's fantastic. But that still means that there's like 50% of kids that aren't getting better. And I think about 10% of people actually get worse throughout the course of therapy. So I think we have a lot more to learn. And I think the ways that we train clinicians also doesn't focus on the how and why of change. It focuses a lot more on the topography of these are the skills, this is what it looks like, so do these things, follow this manual, rather than trying to understand the how and why. And through no fault of their own, we're only starting to understand that side of the science, and it's still not super well articulated. Yeah. But therapies like functional analytic psychotherapy and the interpersonal process and therapy work, which is actually old but kind of got forgotten, and the RFT side of ACT, all those things are starting to articulate that really well. Yeah. And the focus therapy community does a really good job of process coding studies to figure out like what's helpful. But I remember when I read my first EFT textbook and they had these, the markers and tasks of therapy is how they organize that intervention. So when a client shows this or says this kind of thing, that's the marker. And when that marker happens, here's the task. And that's when I really started to get interested and wonder about like, yeah, actually, what is the mechanism of action for therapy? So it's starting, but we're not really training that as the focus. We're still training the topography. And even I've seen a lot of ACT trainings or read ACT workbooks. And they also talk about the topography a lot. Like, here's how you do diffusion. Here are diffusion exercises. Here's how you do present moment awareness. Here's some present moment awareness exercises. And maybe there's a chapter up front about RFT and why that matters. But there's not like this rich integration throughout the manuals of here's why you would do diffusion now instead of later, you know?
Yeah. And I think that we have to cut ourselves a break that the science in this, behavioral science, is very, very new. And we have yet to even complete the shift or know what the end result of the shift is, right? And there's, in my field in applied behavior analysis, when I went to graduate school, it's still, you know, none of this was taught. Contextual behavioral science is not, wasn't primarily taught in ABA. Was still very Skinnerian. Mm-hmm. Now it's kind of moved and shifted past to a post-Skinnerian model of contextual behavioral science and integrating with all these different things that I had never heard of before. When I met with Joanne and she said, "Oh, well, do you know anything about functional analytic psychotherapy?" I said, "Never heard of it before." Right? Now, I come from a tradition of you know, I had a background in philosophy, so I never really had a background in psychology before. I just, as I said, moved into behavioral science. And I'm glad for that philosophical background, because that, you know, I find that lacking as well. But it just seems to me that there is a giant shift going on in trying to integrate all these models and find out what works well and what doesn't work well. Well, one thing I really want to bring up, and you know, Dennis had brought this up, is that the focus of passion-focused therapy about perspective taking, you know, two things: perspective taking, the importance of perspective taking, but also self as context. Can you talk a little bit more about that and the kind of disintegration of the concept, this whole concept of free will, and why that's important?
Sure. Yeah. So what happens in self as context interventions? There's, you know, actually in self as context is the name of the intervention, but there, or the, that branch of the Hexaflex, but within that are the two sub branches. There's self as process, and then there's like the conceptualized self, self definitions kind of stuff. And when you're doing the self as process work, a lot of what you're doing is you're, you know, the RFT guys would say you're engaging all these just shifting dyactic framing, so that you might say, when did you learn? When did you learn that? And how tall were you? And you kind of like get the client to tell you when to stop. Yeah, you were that tall. And can you imagine a little version of you like looking up with tears in your eyes, like you deepen and really enrich the experience?
Yeah, yeah.
And what would you want to say to them? And when you're in that interaction with this imagined part self, this imagined younger self, you're shifting yourself as context, like you're in self as processing. And then later you're going to want to consolidate that, whatever the learning or shifted way of being with yourself was afterwards. You're going to try to consolidate it back into a new conceptualized self or new way of being. And a lot of the training and intervention from a CFT perspective is basically practicing those types of things. And so one of the core like branches of the theory of CFT is this thing they call the tripartite model of affect regulation.
Yeah.
Tripartite means like three parts essentially. And they argue that you social mentalities, you get into these different motive oriented states of minds. You could be in a threat based state of mind where you're detecting and responding to threats. You could be in a drive based state of mind where you're trying to accrue resources and status and power and safety. Or you could be in like this caregiving, compassionate, motive oriented state of mind where you're interested in giving and receiving care.
Yeah, all representing different models of the brain, of the human brain, the reptilian, up to the prefrontal cortex or the human brain, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
No, that's right. And you can look at it, those different stages of evolution. And actually it was really cool because what I like to joke about, like modern phrenology likes to say which parts of the brain are responsible for what. So that there's actually some pretty good functional neuroscience evidence backing up this model. And so what you're trying to do in CFT is you're trying to help people when there's a threat-based mentality activated and it's unhelpful to be in that threat mind, instead of jumping to drive mind where you have that beer and a muffin or you watch a bunch of social media stuff or you watch pornography or you take drugs or you eat a bunch of sugary things, you know, instead of getting rid of the threat mind by distracting and stimulating the drive mind, what you're trying to do is when the threat mind is there, is to activate the compassion or caregiving motive to try to notice that suffering and do what you can to alleviate that suffering. And sometimes that'll mean like validating yourself and meeting your own emotional needs. Sometimes that'll mean actually making a change in the world around you. But when you're making that outward facing change, it's not from a threat perspective where you're attacking others or from a drive perspective where you're clambering for status. But it's from this more stronger, balanced equanimity perspective of caregiving and having your back in a way. And so in order to do that, how do you actually do that? Is you just practice shifting these different motive oriented states of mind from threat based to caregiving or care receiving based. And then in CFT, they argue that there's these different fears, blocks, and resistances that are like, will interrupt your ability to shift. And then most of CFT are these really wonderful interventions to work through those different fears and blocks and resistances. But in the process of doing that, you're shifting these perspectives from the felt sense of self that feels inadequate to the caregiving self. And then so a classic like interchange that you might go through with a client is say like shame or self-criticism is activated right now. And you say, and if you were in contact with that caregiving part of yourself, what would that part say or what would that part want to do? Mm-hmm. And now the client has shifted to this other self-perspective. Oh, they would want to say A, B, C, and D, or they would want to do A, B, C, and D. Great. And can you let that in right now? Can you let that compassion flow in? And no, I can't. Actually, like it's blocked. Okay, so go to that block. What's that block part saying? What's that part of you trying to protect, or what's that part doing? And then you work through that part. So in that interaction, you've shifted from like the felt sense, which you've deepened, to the caregiving sense, to the blocked, the part self that's blocking that caregiving from flowing in. then you stop in that block, and maybe you use the caregiving part self to mollify that block, or maybe you don't. But the work is a lot. I only learned emotion focused therapy later in my training, but because I was doing CFT for so long, it felt really easy for me to learn. Like when I was doing the two, they looked very similar, except that CFT has specific ways of shaping up that caregiving repertoire, whereas in EFT, that caregiving repertoire is expected to naturally emerge just because humans have a tendency towards growth and flourishing.
Right.
Yeah. So that's why I think it's basically like a self as context intervention. And I went to a Portland model meetup with some other ACT clinicians, and people were talking about self as context. And I'd mentioned CFT is basically a self as context intervention in one way. And then we just did like a guided imagery version of like a functional analysis of self-criticism, which is a key CFT thing. And your listeners, and you can just like kind of read the script later if you want. It's in the CFT Distinctive Features book, and also in the Compassion, Practitioner's Guide to Compassion. Basically you shift from just all these different part selves and work through all those blocks, and it's really rich and wonderful, but that's where a lot of the work happens, in my opinion. Mm. And that self-processing kind of branch.
Beautiful. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, and Dennis had brought up too that it's the difference between this is blameless. You're blameless. The difference between being blamed and being responsible, right? So we're not. It's if you can talk a little bit more about that. We're not about blame. We're about taking responsibility for your behaviors. Very, very two different things. But people conflate the two. Talk a little bit more about that.
Sure. And the way the CFT folks talk about that is shifting from self-attack to compassionate self-correction. And one of the key attributes that you're trying to foster in CFT is non-judgment. And by non-judgment, they really mean non-condemnation. So you're not blaming or attacking. Yeah. You're just accepting the world as it is. And there's all these different like metaphors and interventions. So one of them would be like, imagine that you were born with diabetes. That's in no way your fault. But if you eat that tray of cupcakes, you're gonna have something crazy happen to your blood sugar, and it'll be major health outcomes for you. So if you don't wanna die, it's still your responsibility to not eat the cupcakes. It sucks and it's painful because everyone else gets to gorge on that tray of cupcakes and you can't. And there's a lot of unfairness to that, and you work with that pain and suffering, but it's not blame. You'd never blame yourself. I mean, some people would, but you know, like that's a really, I think, clear example where there is no like blame to go around because you're just dealing with it. But there's other things like in CFT trainings, I've heard this thing where like, imagine that as an infant, I was kidnapped. Like as soon as I was in the mat word, I was kidnapped by a violent drug cartel and raised by the leader of that cartel. I don't know, maybe he's impotent or something. And I was raised in as like the heir to this drug empire. You know, what are the chances that I would have committed more violent crime in my life, higher or lower? What do you think?
Higher.
What are the chances I would have experimented with more dangerous drugs?
Yeah, much higher.
The chances I'd have a criminal record.
Higher.
The chances that I'd be a clinician, much lower. The chances that I'd be in this family context, much lower. And so we're all just this one version of ourselves.
Yeah.
That's determined by our lived history and our context. And so part of CFT is helping people unhook from that blame and just recognizing the world as it is and your life as it is. And instead of blaming, saying, if I really want to help me, if I want future Eli to have a bit less suffering or a bit more meaning, what do I need to do more of or less of? Or keep doing to help future Eli just be alleviated a little bit from that suffering. Mm-hmm. And that's where the blame responsibility thing shifts, I think.
Yeah.
I feel like responsibility is also a bit of a loaded term because you're supposed to be responsible and there's like a lot of moralistic connotations to it.
Yeah.
So I'm doing this work. I still need to workshop the name of my group and one of the research questions in the interview that we're asking the youth is like, what's a better name for the program? And so now we're calling it the I Have My Back program. Because really what you're trying to do is figure out like, how can I actually support me and future me to live a life with as like little unnecessary suffering as possible and as much meaning and purpose and fulfillment as possible. And blame just isn't a useful mechanism to promote that, you know. But of course, people have so many fears about reducing blame. Maybe if I don't criticize or blame myself, I won't work as hard. Maybe I won't meet my personal standards. I won't meet my diet or my drinking goals. Yeah. Maybe I won't be as rigid and controlled interpersonally. Yeah. So I'll act like a goof and say things and lose connection. Also, blaming yourself can make the world feel predictable and safe because someone's been held to account. And then also blaming yourself, especially interpersonally, is like a way of preventing other people from attacking you. Like you already took it on the chin, so hopefully other people will attack you. And if you have this assumption that others in the world are hostile and attacking and critical and evaluative, then it's good to evaluate yourself negatively first because there's less chance of other people jumping on that bandwagon. Yeah. And then also, let's say you say, okay, so I'm not going to blame myself, and then you mess up. Mm-hmm. So what do you do next instead of blaming yourself? I mean, that's not a skill that's readily taught in society. So that's what CFT calls the blocks, is like your script for how to respond compassionately has very low data resolution. You know, you kind of have like a sense, but it doesn't come naturally. You don't exactly know what to say or what to do differently instead of blaming. And then just since we're on the fears, blocks, resistance thing, then resistances would be like, okay, I'm on board. I'm not going to blame myself anymore. I'm just going to like, I'm not the problem. The problem's the problem. How do I solve the problem? I've accepted that and I know how to support myself compassionately, but you just can't. There's some emotional unwillingness. It feels dangerous. It feels like there's just this, when I write about it, I'll put like, because it's like, no, I don't want that caring to come in. I don't want to let go of that criticism. Yeah. It feels really, that's what the...
feels very unnatural, right? It's very, if I feel that my coherence is attached to feeling stupid or ugly or whatever, there's a comfort in that because it is predictable.
Right.
Even though I know it's self-harming.
Mm-hmm, for sure. But I think it can also be from a sense that in other caregiving relationships in your lived history, when you've received that care and understanding, if that was an unpredictable relationship and you were also abused or attacked or punished, or there was like just a lot of erraticism in that relationship, then when you access that soothing, I mean, it's just automatically coupled with threat-based feelings, right? Because that's how soothing was coupled throughout your lived history.
Right.
And so it's not even just that it's not predictable. It can activate that core sense of danger and also inadequacy. Because,
that's right.
Yeah. You know, there's those cool studies. It's not that cool for the rats where they gave some rats an electrocution and a loud noise and other rats an electrocution and that liquid that made them throw up. Mm-hmm. And then other rats, they gave the throw up liquid with a really, you know, bad smell. And then they gave the rats the throw up fluid with a loud noise. And rats learned quicker, the fear stimulus was trained quicker when the shock and the noise went together and when the smell and the vomit went together. Mm-hmm. You know, like it was harder for rats to learn about vomit in the context of a loud noise. Mm-hmm. Than it was to shock and a loud noise. You know what I mean? Like those things kind of go together in a way.
Yeah.
And I have this kind of private belief that shame and interpersonal damage go together because shame is a self-conscious and socially based emotion. Mm. Just like how you can learn like a vomit kind of response in the presence of a smell way quicker. I think you can also learn shame in the context of an emotion a lot quicker. And I think that's why complex trauma kind of stuff is more associated with shame-based and self-critical kinds of difficulties later in life than like single event or violent trauma, which is more related to like fear-based difficulties later in life. Yeah. I think it just kind of lines up that way. And So when you're trying to let that care flow in, I mean, you're activating that whole interpersonal network, which if it has been dangerous or unpredictable or anything, it's just going to elicit the reverse of emotions. And then I think our brains are all wired differently. Some of us are just born with a brain that's super easy for shame stuff to stick to it. Like we have crazy Velcro for doing bad interpersonally. And so you could live in like the most supportive context ever. But if your brain will pick up on even the smallest eye roll or the smallest sigh, and that means like the world to a person.
Yeah.
Even though it was like outwardly looking in, it was like a safe interpersonal relationship from the person's lived experience. They were getting injured multiple times. And so those learning histories are going to get laid down in much the same way as they would if it was a more noxious environment.
Yeah. And ending on a high note too, is all those variations, you know, I just read that all those variations have an evolutionary explanation. They're not bad things. It's not bad to be, to have high anxiety. Right. That's what has kept us alive and not eaten for a long time. But when it comes to human language and development of language in the past, you know, couple hundred thousand years or so, it does have, you know, a large net. It's a double-edged sword. And I feel like we can talk a lot about this. It is now talking about this about an hour and 15 minutes. I want to be respectful of your time. Do you want to mention anything that we haven't talked about?
I don't think so. I think this is a nice like beginning discussion.
Yeah.
On CFT. Yeah. I think it's a great intervention, and I'd encourage people to look into that if they're looking for something else, to another model instead of technologies to supplement their skills.
If a person came to you and said, hey, listen, I'm really interested in becoming a therapist and doing what you do, what would you recommend them to learn or focus on?
To be a therapist in general? That's a pretty interesting question, Hugh. Well, I think
there's so much out there.
Yeah, there is. Like my bias is obviously really pro contextual behavior sciences. Yeah. So from like a skills building perspective, I would say jump into the contextual behavior science world. Two books that I found really transformational for me. One was Mindfulness for Two.
I've heard of that. Yeah.
And the two in that book is a therapist and the client. It's not a couple's book. It's therapist and client. And that book does a really good job of articulating the different ways in which you can jump into the present moment and work with clients in the here and now. And their account of relational frame theory at the beginning is also really easy to understand. I was like a bit of a light bulb. I did like the Foxy Learning, and I read the post-Skinnerian account of language and all that stuff. But when I read the intro to that one, I was like, oh, that's what they mean. And then another one is The ACT Practitioner's Guide to Compassion. I thought that was such a great.
By Tersh. Is that by Tersh? By
Tersh and Lorenzo. Yeah. And somebody else. I have it kicking around here somewhere.
Mindfulness for Two is by whom? Who wrote that? Do you remember?
Kelly Wilson wrote it.
Kelly Wilson,
lost somewhere in my bookcase.
Yeah. And later this month, I sit down with Yvonne Barnes Holmes to talk about PBBT, process behavioral therapy. And I sat down with her last month, but then I didn't know what I was doing with Zoom, so I lost the whole thing. So I have to, you know, she was pleasant enough to redo it later this month.
Nice.
You live and learn.
Yeah.
This has been a joy. Thank you so much for.
Can I just say one more thing before we sign off? Is that the actual CFT like foundational textbook is written by Paul Gilbert, and it's called CFT Distinctive Features or something like that. So obviously, I would read that too.
Yeah, and he also has a website, correct, devoted to CFT.
I think it's the Compassionate Mind Foundation. And that's where you do all the accreditation for the CFT stuff. They even have like 3-month long courses where you can become a CFT clinician. And yeah, that group, that research group is spearheading a little bit. So But I did all my CFT training through Praxis with Dennis and Laura.
Excellent.
They often run CFT trainings through there.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make sure we mentioned Paul and his group. I didn't.
Yes. Well, like,
His baby.
And he's out of Australia or is he out of England? I can't remember.
So out of the UK, University of Derby in the UK.
Okay. All right.
Then Australia, there's a research group with Kirby who's spearheading CFT for caregivers. Okay. They're not looking at the caregiver intervention as a supplement to helping kids. It's just to help caregivers because being a parent's an impossible job and so easy to beat yourself up about it.
Yeah.
So that's a big group in Australia.
Well, I hope to get really good in this because I want to have a compassion competition with Dennis Hirsch
While we're on the topic, then there's the other group, which is Kristen Neff and Germer doing their mindfulness self-compassion stuff, and that's kind of like a whole other branch, and they all overlap. So I just don't leave them out because they do really wonderful work. And Germer's collating this kind of like association, or I'm not really sure what the point of it is, but like what counts as a compassion-based therapy. And there's going to be like an institute or some kind of body that looks at compassion-based therapies. And so they're doing a lot of work kind of like on that side too. Sorry to interrupt. And thanks for having me here.
It's been a pleasure. Yeah. Thank you so much for being a part. I learned an incredible amount and I hope that other people will too and look into it more heavily.
And I'm running a training on CFT for adolescents through the Ontario ACBS chapter.
Okay.
So if you're on the ACBS website, kind of like check in with our chapter from time to time. We also have our webpage for the chapter where it'll get announced when it happens. So that will be coming soon.
Awesome. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. We'll try to survive here in the United States. Yeah. Don't forget about us. We're not all crazy. There's a lot of say. We're getting saner. So things are we're going through some growing pains right now. But thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Okay.
Take care.
Bye for now.
Bye.